I'm Kevin Oste, and on this episode of VA Radio, I'm joined once again by Brian Stupski of Problem Child Customs and Studio PCK, and we are talking a little bit about a big week in the automotive world, as last weekend was the Detroit Autorama, in which they crowned the Riddler Award winner for 2015. We had talked about discussing Autorama before the event, but now I think it's actually cooler to do it after.
Oh, definitely. You get to kind of play Monday morning quarterback, and that'll be a fun move.
Yeah, and you certainly had a fun time on your Facebook page throwing a few topics out, which, you know, for those who didn't see it, it was another... I don't want to use the word typical because none of the Brian Stupski rants are typical, but this one was on par, I should say, with some of the others that was very thought-provoking and garnered hundreds of responses from people based on some of your reflections and thoughts about the current state of Autorama, not necessarily in particular, but high-end car shows and high-end cars.
Definitely, yeah. I didn't expect it to go quite as big as it did. I thought, oh, maybe I'll get, you know, 20 or 30 replies and we'll kind of discuss this a little bit. But yeah, it kind of took on a life of its own.
That's to say the least, yeah. Well, and what I thought was pretty interesting is not only were there a lot of responses, but as I was reading this, I thought, man, I have a lot of thoughts on this. And my fingers looked at me and they said, don't make us type this. Just call them. Please. So here we are today.
Probably for the best.
Yeah, right. So basically, the Detroit Autorama is home to the Riddler Award and the Grade 8, which congratulations, by the way, on designing a car that was in the Grade 8.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and the Grade 8 are 8 cars chosen from the whole show, and then they crown the Riddler Award, which is named after Don Riddler, who was a tremendous car show promoter and had a lot to do with custom cars in the show car world. And today, the Riddler Award is widely regarded as the most prestigious custom car award you can get. And I think a close neck-and-neck second would be the America's Most Beautiful Roadster Award what the heck's the name of it now?
The Grand National Roadster Show.
Grand National Roadster Show. Yeah, my mind keeps wanting to say Oakland. It used to be the Oakland Roadster Show, but then they moved it to L.A., and now it's Grand National. The level of cars that show up at this thing every year just continues to be mind-boggling, and I think that was some of the points you were making with your commentary about, what's really happening here with show cars and with high-profile cars, expensive builds, and all this kind of stuff, and... there are so many different directions and thoughts that I have on this, and I don't want to be frustrating, but this is not a topic to me that is like civil rights. You know, there is no it's not a cause. it's not, some giant thing that I feel super passionately about. I recognize pretty much all sides of this thing. I just think it needs it's worthy of some interesting discussion. So why don't you give us a little summary of some of the points you're making about the Riddler, not necessarily the Riddler winner, but the event this past weekend?
Well, I don't get me wrong. I make a living designing cars. I mean, this is what I do. I kind of work in that industry where we provide, you know, dreams for people. We illustrate things. We come up with things that'll, you know, make people think and hopefully broaden someone's imagination. My rant really that I kind of went off on was basically just kind of the direction I think more or less the perception of the public is for what we do versus what, you know, is really going on. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you've got million-dollar cars competing for an award, that says something about, you know, how people feel about this hobby and what they're willing to invest into it. You know, because, I mean, if you're going to build a car over, say, a 5 or 7 year period and drop almost every penny you have into it to try to make a statement, be it design or, hey, dig me, whatever your motivation is, that says a lot that you believe enough in what you do and you hope that people will appreciate it enough to warrant that expense, you know, and that investment and everything else. What my problem starting to become was it's really kind of drifted away, I think, from the spirit of kind of, I guess, perfecting the art or advancing the art of design or creation of something, you know, really over the top to inspire someone. And it's kind of become this this sort of weird, hey, look how much money I can spend. Look how much I can throw at this car. It's really drifted, I think, far away from the spirit of things. I mean, I can't imagine, and I don't want to speak for him, but I can't imagine that Don Riddler ever sat back and said, wow, I really hope to see the day when we have a car that someone invested, you know, $20,000 into to have custom door pulls made. It's really kind of gone off the rails.
Well, I think there's an assumption there, though, when you said if somebody spent $1 million or all the money they had. I mean, I think in some cases, the people that are investing in these cars, they've got many, 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 many millions. So that million might not carry the same weight. I'm sure $1 million is $1 million, no matter who you are. But if you have a lot more in the bank, then, and you want to go have fun with your $1 million and build a car, maybe that's just what it is.
Oh, definitely. And I think everything kind of falls into, you know, into some sort of perspective. Like you said, I mean, if you have $200 billion laying around, $1 million on a car is, again, it's a drop in the bucket. You know, for an average guy to say, hey, he's got, you know, $100,000 into a car, that's a pretty big investment. You know, I mean, if you're getting into the kind of money for a vehicle that is what used to be maybe a really nice home, it skews things just a little bit. I mean, the demographic suddenly shifts from, hey, this is a hobby everybody can enjoy. If you only look at one segment of it, it becomes something where it's kind of a rich man's game.
Well, do you think that, and again, we're speaking in abstracts because we didn't, I guess we should backtrack just a little bit. The car that won this year is a Foos creation that is, it started life technically, I guess, as an 09 Corvette and has been reskinned and modified and mixed with a 65 Chevy Impala called the Impostor. Oh, yeah. And it has just about everything you could do to a car. It's been lengthened, shortened, stretched, pulled, custom trim, paint, body panels, driveline. I mean, everything you could touch on this car has been touched. And it was, I don't know what the build price was, obviously very expensive. And but I don't know the owner of the car. I don't know the guy that commissioned him. And I don't know why this was done. I don't know if this guy woke up one day and said, hey, I want a shortened Corvette Impala. Or if he said, hey, Chip, build something you think is cool and I'll be the guy to make it happen. Or if, as you suggest, some guy said, hey, you know, I want to be the big dog. I don't care what it costs. Let's, you know, you make me something and it's an ego-driven thing. It could be part of all the above. I don't know. But one thing that you said that I want to explore is that, to me, it doesn't really matter what that motivation was. I think they do push the limits of creativity because...
Oh, yeah. And that car, man, that car really did, if you think about it from almost any aspect that the Impostor had. I mean, great engineering, a lot of thought. I mean, if you stop to think about what it takes to basically rebody a 65 Impala to fit onto a late model, you know, Corvette chassis, that's mind-boggling to begin with. And to pull it off the way that Chip did, man, that's even better. I mean, you know, man, he managed to, in typical Chip Foose fashion, not only make it really trick in every possible way you can look at that car, but he found a way to almost keep his restyling of the car kind of current with almost like that, the modern like Chevrolet and GM design ethos. So it really stuck not only to keep the original character of the car, but kind of fell into like some really good form language that made it blend almost naturally with that chassis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the car is incredible any way you look at it, which kind of brings me into my next thought, which is why I said before, please don't get frustrated with me because I'm not taking a stand in any particular direction here. But I think once you look at that car and recognize that, you know, it's over the top, first of all, maybe you know, we've never defined what the top is because the top keeps moving, you know, and as things go over that top, you know, next year, you know, the top changes and that has an effect on everybody else building a car in the world. And this kind of gets back to what you were saying with the spirit of somebody building a custom car in the garage and wanting to show up at the same show. There's a giant disconnect. But then I think, well, this is the Riddler. And no matter what, this show has now positioned itself as the pinnacle. So if you're going to build a car to go for the pinnacle, you got to go over the top.
Exactly. You're not going to have, you know, I always kind of looked at it like almost like a beauty pageant. At this level, you have, you know, it's just like the Miss World or Miss Universe pageant. You've got the best of the best coming out. You're not going to have, and nothing against her, I'm sure she's a nice lady, but you're not going to have the girl who won the wet t-shirt contest at the bar the night before. You know, it's a little bit of a different world.
Yeah, right. It's not your local car show. It's the Super Bowl.
Right.
So having said all that, there are things about the car that you and I and every other individual looked at it may or may not like. And that's our own opinions and everybody's got them. And, you know.
Oh, yeah. And that's the beauty of it. You know, it really opens it up to interpretation and it gives people a chance. I mean, yeah, again, everybody can be that Monday morning designer, but, you know, or a keyboard warrior, as we found. I did some research on the car and that's one of the things that kind of led me to post what I did. It was just a lot of people who couldn't grasp things that were going on, wanted to post their opinion on it, and they had no backing whatsoever, you know, for their arguments. It was just, oh, I thought this was ugly. And you think, man, I didn't have time to sit there and reply to every person online and say, you know, well, your opinion is wrong, because yeah, that drags me down to that level. But on the same token, you know, I agree with you. There was a lot of, there's a lot of discussion about just dopey little things about that car.
Right. Well, and some opinions carry more weight than other. I mean, you know, as much as we hate critics, a good critic has a solid understanding of all the elements and, you know, has an opinion that has value as opposed to, yeah, I think that sucks, you know.
Right.
One of the controversial topics on that car was the wheel choice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and again, I think somewhere we'll have I have pictures of the car on our website that we'll put next to it. And again, I am completely far removed from the car because I haven't seen it in person. I didn't talk to Chip or anybody else involved with it. Knowing Mr. Foose, there is a reason for that wheel choice. The wheel choice is, to me, I thought it was interesting because it's like the brightest, shiniest, chromiest thing on the car. And oh, yeah. The design is a multi-spoke thin wheel that's very large, and it's, you know, some of the comments were it was disproportionately sized or the, you know, whatever. And wheels, as you know, as a designer, there's a handful of wheels that'll work on just about anything. And then when you start to venture out a little bit, that's when people start speaking up. And I think that's what was happening.
Definitely. Yeah. And I don't want to make this all about, you know, Chip's wheel choice.
No, not at all.
You know, I looked at it from the point of view that, hey, you know, again, back to the underpinnings of the car, you're taking a late model Corvette chassis and trying to make everything there work so you have that kind of performance level underneath this custom body skin. And at that point, you've already limited yourself to, you know, what your wheel offset can be, because once you deviate from that, I mean, you're really getting into things like re-engineering everything in the rear suspension of that car, moving wheel tubs, shifting around where exhaust is going to be, rerouting all the electronics. And I think that really took away from, you know, where the project seemed to be heading. Everything I read about it was that they wanted to keep all of that stuff intact underneath and just work on, you know, concentrating on the body part of it.
Right.
So, I mean, right off the bat, you've limited yourself to what the offset is going to be, what diameter you can use, you know, all those things. And again, it might have been a situation, like I said, I don't know. I didn't see the car in person, unfortunately, and I haven't had a chance, you know, sit down and pick Chip's brain on it. But I can imagine that, you know, there were concessions to be made somewhere, be it from the engineering standpoint or maybe it was just a case of that is the wheel the owner liked and chose. And when you're building a car like that, you know, the owner of the car signing the checks, and eventually you've got to say, well, I'm going to give him what he wants.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And getting back to the engineering, I mean, the reason, I mean, that's a Z06 Corvette you're looking at. So that eliminates a set of 14-inch stamped steel Chevy Rallies. You know, it's just, right. The speed sensors are going to be off, the ABS, the scrub radius, you know, everything's going to be wrong. So,
and exactly.
I don't really have an opinion on the wheels so much as just as an example of a talking point of where people got flared up.
No, and exactly. And I think that was the main point that everyone brought up. And the funny part is, when I first saw pictures of the car start to hit, I didn't even notice the wheels. I was paying so much attention to, you know, how he had moved panels, where he had put things, how lines were, you know, working from the original car onto the new proportions. And I think one of the last things I even looked at were the wheels. And I said, wow. I said, okay. I said, a little bright, but, you know, I mean, then again, I'm sure he could come and take me to school on why he chose those wheels and how bright they are. And I'd walk away with my tail between my legs. So it, like I said, it's really, to me, the wheels were a non-issue. Again, though, but I mean, I guess everybody's got to complain about everything. So,
well, yeah, and I don't want to get too far off the whole topic of, you know, kind of the hows and whys and what's the state of the world if, you know, do you need to have $1 million car to be the cool kid now? You know, is that the question? Or can you get away with doing something that's not as crazy? But then again, it's like I said before, this is the top competition, so you expect to see that kind of stuff.
Definitely. Yeah, and again, this is, I tried to mention that in the piece that I wrote, where this isn't like the low level, you know, this isn't the Thursday night cruise at your local burger place. This is kind of the Super Bowl of, you know, what we do. So you're going to see the biggest and baddest stuff come out. And the point here is to be as far over the top as possible. Because, you know, like I said in the piece, you know, my inspiration, anytime I hear indoor car show, I think back to when I was a kid. And the first cars you see at an indoor show are usually the really radical, over the top, you know, show rods. You know, you see things like, you know, the toilet car and the weird stuff like that.
Yeah. And that was a great, great vision that you created, because I remember vividly going to car shows at 4, 5, 6 years old. And exactly what you're saying, the stuff that didn't look like anything on the street is what stuck.
Exactly. And it was like dream world. You walked in there and you thought, man, there are colors here you never see out in nature. There was more chrome, you know, gosh, gold plating, etching, pinstriping. It was sensory overload, to, you know, steal someone else's line. But you kind of came home, and as, you know, at least I did as a kid, all I wanted to do was draw things like that, try to build model cars of those, you know, the ones I had seen at the show. It really inspired you to do kind of out of the box things. Yeah, I don't think you'd go to, you know, like the drag strip and want to build, again, you know, like the bathtub car or a couch and take it down the drag strip. You know, but, you know, you go to an indoor show and those are the kind of things you came home with. You're like, man, I need to have a, you know, I'm not going to dive back into the van thing, but we know what happens when that
right.
starts.
But,
it's, you know, you see these things that are so out there and you get psyched up and you get jazzed. And those are the things that kind of etch their place in my brain, where you sort of set a range. You say, okay, if I'm building or designing this kind of car, I can go to X point on the map. If somebody says, hey, I want to build a car that really brings people back to the golden age of indoor shows and show rods and the neat stuff, well, then all bets are off and it's just a wide open, you know, path ahead of me. You can do anything you want. So I definitely think, I mean, there's no doubt there's a place for this. And I, deep in my heart, I love it. I might pick on some things, but I mean, I love seeing how far someone can take creativity, because that is, again, that's the name of the game that I'm in.
Right. Absolutely.
But, you know, I do think you brought up a really interesting point where, you know, does it just become, you know, a game for people who have an unlimited budget or more money than they know what to do with. Because what happens is, especially with social media, you don't really see a lot of the pictures of the other cars that are there. You don't see, I mean, you see some of the stuff that's downstairs, but you don't see every car that's on the floor. And I think there's a pretty good representation at almost any show of virtually any budget and any skill level.
At a good show, yeah, right.
You know, and you kind of fall into this thing where maybe people base everything kind of on that show, sort of like they do on a reality TV show, where now all of a sudden everybody has to have the 16-room mansion and wear, you know, $40,000 sneakers and drive a gold-plated SUV. You start to think, hey, wow, all these guys build for these shows are these, you know, million-dollar cars with one-off everything. And I'm sure if you're not really into it, or maybe you don't have a big car scene in your area, maybe you think that you're just going to be outclassed. And at that point, it becomes either, well, what's the point? Or the converse is maybe you rebel and you have things pop up kind of like the rat rod movement.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, that the media is the big filter, and the message that's getting out there isn't necessarily accurate of what the scene is, so to speak. And in fact, one of the things that we did on our own website was posted a gallery of over 250 photos from that whole show. You know, it's not just the Grade 8, which are, you know, how could I say just the Grade 8? You know, these are the top 8 cars chosen there. They're awesome stuff, and those are included too. But there was all kinds of stuff there that wasn't getting out, that, you know, again, things that weren't necessarily hand-built, but just clean cars that somebody brought out. And those, I get as much inspiration from seeing those as, you know, some one-off hand-built thing, because it's almost more intriguing to see how somebody did a super bad car without any money.
Oh, exactly. That's, and like you said, I mean, you guys had a great gallery online. And the funny thing is, if I bet you a lot of the people that were arguing about, you know, their opinions on a car, say online, didn't venture anywhere past Facebook, where maybe they caught just the Grade 8. And they think that's the whole show.
Right.
You guys really put up, I mean, you showed that there's a really big scope there.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
And that was kind of funny how that happened. Just a guy on lateralg.net said, hey, I'm going out to the show. And I said, would you mind taking a whole bunch of pictures? And he said, I love doing that. So that was it. You know, there was no set mission. It was just, let's just see I couldn't go, so I needed somebody to take me there. That's really what it was. I'm not going to lie to you.
That's how I do it. I live vicariously through that whole weekend. I just, you know, I have someone sending me pictures, and you know, I get to play, you know, armchair, you know, showgoer. So it's,
yeah. So
I might want to work on that name for it. But
I think another thing that is interesting, and this gets back to the general public walking through a show like that, and what I see happening, and it's kind of silly, people walking through a car show that aren't necessarily huge car fanatics. They might be what I just call car lovers. They just like things with wheels that are cool. Right. They might not own a car. They might have had something a long time ago. They're just, you know, the general public. They might walk right past all the cars in the Grade 8 and not notice anything. I mean, they might not be affected at all. And they might go to a stock red 69 Camaro and spend the whole afternoon there.
Right on. And that's kind of the beauty of it, too. You know, there's definitely something for everyone.
And I've seen this in person, because in fact, a car we've done some work on here in the shop, a neighbor of mine had a clone 69 Z28. It was just an original V8 car, but it wasn't a Z. And it had a small block in it, and it was cranberry red with black stripes, and it was a round headlight non-RS car. Really nothing fancy. It was pretty straight. It was shiny. You know, we knew the floors had sheet metal screws in them, and there was some bad rust repairs and stuff. But it presented well in public, and he would go to car shows and come home with trophy after trophy after trophy after trophy. And, you know, to think somebody might have spent, you know, the kind of shows we're talking about, maybe $250,000 to have a car sitting next to it that might have gone unnoticed. And the guy with the stock looking car gets all the glory, you know. So the public is fickle about what they see. And then you start to really go insane thinking, well, really, now why am I doing all this?
Exactly. And I think even on obviously on your side, you want to build as clean of a car as you can for someone who wants a vehicle like that. On my side, I wind up with that, I think, kind of that weird side too, where we've got to play kind of, you know, you got to sort of think ahead and figure out what the next trend is or what people are going to like. Because, you know, you could pour your heart and soul into a car and go, this is the greatest, baddest thing I've ever put together. And it goes to a show and either people don't like it or they walk right past it. It's really a matter of just the taste that of the people who walk past it at that particular time.
Yeah, knowing your audience and going, you know, does it matter that the local guys don't care? I mean, we've done a lot of cars here that had a million subtle little high-end touches that weren't picked up. But you take it to a SEMA or you show it to a magazine guy and they get it immediately, or somebody who's really, you know, into that kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, you said it. I mean, the guy who owns the car is the one that has to be happy.
Oh, definitely. And I think it's funny, too. You mentioned how, you know, the local guys might skim over all these tiny little really trick one-off touches you put into a car. And at the same time, if you go to SEMA, they overlook all the stuff like, hey, this guy must have spent, you know, 400 hours trying to get the quarter straight on that car. And they focus in on that one tiny little detail piece, you know, that you kind of thought up maybe, you know, along the way. And you're like, hey, I'm proud of that. But man, I'm really proud of the bodywork, and they could care less. Meanwhile, the local guy is trying to figure out how you got the car that straight.
Right.
And well, it's kind of funny. There's a, I don't want to say it's a disconnect. It's a totally different way of looking at things.
Well, it puts a lot of responsibility on the car, because a car like, again, to use the Foose Imposter, it does all that.
Oh, yeah. That he's, gosh, he's one of those guys who can design something for everyone. And I've always thought, you know, you could take any person at any level of interest in cars, put one of his vehicles in front of them, and they get it. And that's, to me, that's mind-boggling. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe my brain works differently than his, where, you know, I try to zone in and I say, hey, this is what we're going after with the car, and we stick to it. And maybe he just figures in some grand scheme that, you know, he's some kind of transcendental, you know, genius.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you're right there with him. I mean, I wouldn't take anything away from you. And is I think the important thing is that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's him or you or anybody, you got to be true to the car and true to what the goal is. And I think that's where cars kind of fall by the wayside, is when they don't have a central design mission or performance mission, and you just start throwing stuff at it, and then it all, you know, goes down the toilet.
Oh, yeah. And oh my gosh, you run into that more often than you'd care to. And I've always get kind of a theory that somewhere along the way, from, you know, in the history of custom cars, I mean, not to go off on too much of a sidebar, but like if you look back on it, you say, okay, the first custom cars, you had a little bit of customization going on because, you know, maybe one guy didn't want to drive the same car that his neighbor had. So you start off with paint, and then you move into a little bit of, you know, coach building. Next thing you know, you've got the guys who say, well, I'm going to upfit my car with different trim or maybe different parts to make it look like a level up on the rung or maybe a newer model. After a while, you kind of run into the situation where it's like, hey, well, that was cool. We put different trim on it. Now I want to make my own trim or use pieces of trim to make something unique. And after a while, you run into the situation where maybe what you have is kind of like we saw, again, going back to early car shows and indoor stuff, where it stopped being just about using off-the-shelf things and really modifying things and trying to combine a couple different cars and pieces to making one-off parts. Then eventually you get to a point where you've saturated, you used up everything you could at some point, and you just start trying to bolt two things together that nobody's ever bolted together before. Mm-hmm. And that kind of becomes the statement. And I think at that point you lose the whole purpose of customizing. you know, it's no longer just a visual thing. It becomes this, you know, what can I do more than this guy did?
Yeah, right. The evolution is gone.
Oh, yeah. You start point chasing. And I mean, we've seen that happen in the past where I think, again, the indoor thing, if you look back on some of the Riddler winners, and I'll never take anything away from the guys who won it. And granted, I mean, you can look at anything and say, oh, music from this period was not my taste, or maybe movies from another period aren't your taste.
Yeah, but there's some stuff in Riddler history that you would think they wouldn't even let in the show at this point.
Oh, exactly. And that's kind of the fun of it. I make it a point every year. I almost have all of them like kind of ingrained in some way in my memory. But I go back through and usually I try to do this like maybe that Friday or even early that Saturday of the show, kind of look back at all the past winners. And if you take them in like groups of like 5 or 6 years, you can start to see a trend developing. Mm-hmm. And you kind of know what the judges might be looking for, what the people might like, you know, what's going on in the, you know, that particular niche of the hobby. And you can kind of pick out where it's going to go the following year. And then you compare that to the grade eight of that present year. And usually I can knock it down to, you know, my top three of the grade eight. And been pretty successful so far picking every year, knowing what's going to take the big prize, just based on prior winners and looking at what the cars are in that field. So it's kind of funny. I mean, it's definitely you sparked it when you said evolutionary, and I thought, man, it's, if you look at it, there's really one of those bizarre evolutionary charts. I'd love to see, it'd be a really big t-shirt to do that on.
But yeah, it would be pretty funny, like the evolution of man from ape chart thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and the other day I was thinking about this too, on that design evolution. 30s cars in America, you know, the purists say that a 30 Plymouth looks much different from a 30 Chevrolet, but in reality, and you know, the silhouette of those cars is identical. And same with late 50s cars, and same with cars today. And I think you're suggesting that the winners of that show, or the high mark of that show, kind of follows a little bit of that. And it might not be the actual car, but the things that are done to them.
Definitely. Yeah, I think there's certain design elements, or maybe, and I don't want to say it's a certain style, because I mean, a lot of these cars, you know, people don't start to build them the day after, you know, say Detroit this year. I don't think there are many cars that are going to show next year that started that Monday after the show. No. You're really dealing with a stretch where you could have a car that's been going on for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years.
Sure.
And it might debut this coming year. But I think that people kind of fall into a thing where I don't think we're going to see the day when a traditional 50 Mercury shows up and, you know, takes the big prize. I don't want to take anybody away from trying to do that.
It'd be awesome if somebody brought one.
I'd love it. I would love to see that in the grade eight.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. It'd be one of those cars that would really shake it up. Yeah. But I mean, I think you're going to see, you know, it just, everything kind of, it gets ramped up year after year. You know, and even after this year, seeing the stuff that was there, there were so many trick things going on with each one of the cars in that grade eight.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And man, I mean, it was a pretty inspiring field. And even more so, looking at the cars that didn't make that cut. You know, you've always got your little picks where you go, man, how did that car not get chosen?
Yeah.
And again, you know, not being there, not seeing the car up close, and there had to be a reason somebody didn't pick it.
Well, and there's only eight. So, you know, that's a problem if you have 15 super over-the-top cars.
Exactly. You got to whittle it down. And
Right. Well, one thing that I've noticed, and this is a little hard to articulate, but maybe you'll appreciate it or you'll just think I'm crazy. But the current trend of the super high dollar cars, to me, I think the hardest thing, or the one element that seems to kind of get lost, and this is just me and I'm nobody, but they start to feel like they're losing some of the soul. And the design might be there, but technology is to the point now where the top shops all have, you know, 5-axis CNC machines making parts, and they've got guys doing metal work that was you wouldn't even think of doing, you know, even 10 years ago, and 3D printing and stuff that is very, very technical. And the goal was always to make a nice car by hand. You know, you have to refine every surface and tighten the gaps and smooth them and get them arrow straight like you suggested. And then when the outside of the car is done, well, now let's move inside and smooth out everything under the hood and on the sides and, you know, all the reliefs and the imperfections of door skins crinkling over the shell and all that kind of stuff. And the new parts that they can make with the machines don't have any inherent flaws. Whatever you can dream up, they'll have. So you're getting more and more perfection in the pieces and the overall package. And to me, as I walk down the aisles at Walmart, okay, and stay with me, the goal of those machines was to make parts cheaper, faster, lighter. I mean, if you look at a coffee maker, for crying out loud, you go to Walmart, you buy a coffee maker for $20. Well, that was designed, that $20 covers the design, the manufacturer in a different country, the materials going into it, the shipping to get that country from there to here, the marketing and advertising, you know, expense of making somebody know the, you know, the coffee maker brand and all that stuff, and the overhead of the store and paying the people. That's all wrapped up in that $20. So how cheaply has this thing been made? But it has design elements that I will call smart, you know, because it does what it needs to do, and it has a surface texture and a shine and a color and, you know, design elements visually to make it stand out from the other coffee makers on the shelf. And it seems like the zillion-dollar cars are taking a lot of that same school and applying these finishes and these levels of design smartness and perfection to what was a 60s muscle car. And I'm not sure what is happening. You know what I'm saying? It's like, why would you want a car that is supposed to be tire smoke and gasoline and speed and something that was crazy fun to drive and refine it to a level of being a manufactured thing where it seems like the soul is sucked out of it? Does any of that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And I couldn't agree more. I was sitting there the whole time just nodding my head going, oh yeah, I get it. we've almost it's funny. It's kind of like we've tripped over that line and gone from automotive craftsmen, you know, the guys who would, you know, bang out a panel over a buck that they made and create these one-off parts, to almost a level of industrial designers and engineers stepping in and trying to package a vehicle so that it is, you know, as close to perfection as possible. And don't get me wrong. I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. You always want to strive for the best in anything.
Well, yeah, right.
I mean, I wouldn't want to have, you know, you don't want to have a guy who, say you go to the butcher shop and he doesn't care what he gives you. You know, you want a pork chop and you wind up with some, you know,
a knuckle,
hunk of meat,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
God knows what part of the animal, but...
And I love the tools and I love the technology and I love the ability to make things that nice. I think the challenge, and I'm not saying anything negative against any of those cars, I think the challenge is maybe the next level is to do something at that level of industrial manufactured perfection, but still have the soul of the hand-built. And don't get me wrong, when these cars were new, they weren't hand-built by GM or Ford or Chrysler or anybody. They were machines being made by machines, but they had... You know, their imperfections, their idiosyncrasies, and things that kind of gave them that individual. You know, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here.
They had an identity of their own. I mean, and I had a talk like this earlier in the week, where it's really hard to use the word soul with a car if someone thinks that you're talking about, oh, it's going to come to life and, you know, be a part of the family.
No.
It's a thing, you know, you ascribe that to a car because it has, again, it's that certain something that you can't put your finger on. It's just, you like it, you don't know why, and you could probably science the thing to death and say, hey, it's because this form appeals to your eye and this intersection of angles is just very pleasing to you, the way your mind is wired. But I agree with you. There's something, there's almost that disconnect. It's like if you watch traditional animation where it was hand-drawn, you know, back in the 40s, and these guys did it frame by frame versus something that's computer animated today where it's super fluid and you can pan the camera around and get just these extreme angles. It's neat to watch, and it boggles your mind that it can be done. But on the same token, there's that little bit of a disconnect from, I think, the human hand to that point.
Right, and I think the image becomes so precise, so sanitary, that it loses the human element in humanity. It's no longer, you know, we can't identify with it anymore because we can't make that with our hands, you know, and maybe that's what it is.
Exactly, and I mean, I run into that. Oh man, I have a project on my board right now that's really fighting me that way, where we're going to do a lot of trick little things to it that'll all be machine made, but you feel disconnected from it at the end because you know that the gaps are going to be flawless. And I think, and it's not that I want to look at a car and find a flaw.
No, not at all.
Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, as much as the next guy, I want to see that perfect gap on a door. I want to see all those things. But I really like it, though, when you see it, you can relate to it. And you say, hey, that piece of trim, I know why that trim fits the way it does.
Yes, as opposed to maybe somebody just had a machine and they made some parts and just stuck them on the car.
Exactly. I think you nailed it. It's not
a rally against the machines and the machining. Ooh. It's making parts that still fit with the concept. And
oh, definitely. And we're at a point in this whole thing where we have these great machines available to us. We can do stuff now that you couldn't dream about doing in, say, the early 90s. And to see it done at such a level that it is, where, you know, somebody can come in and say, well, I'd really like to have a car that I can, you know, have these, you know, these parting lines and this flush fit piece. And I don't want to, you know, make it sound easier than it is, but literally within a week or two, you can have those parts made.
Yeah, right.
You know, everything can be rapid prototyped.
Well, and there's where the new direction of creativity lies too. The ability to have somebody, you know, dream up the part, you know, SolidWorks model the part or whatever program they're going to use, and then have the machines and the ability to communicate with the machines, and the machines make the stuff that is what you envisioned. That's a whole nother level.
Oh yeah, and it's definitely ramped it up. You've got to be pretty quick on your feet at this point and really understand not only, again, the design part. You know, anybody can draw a really cool looking part, but if you've got a guy who can draw the part, understand the manufacturing that's going to go beyond, you know, on behind the scenes to make that part, and then what it's going to take to install that part, put the finish on that part, make it survive, make it work. That really ramped everything up. I think we're at a point now where you've got to have your hands in almost every aspect of it just to understand it and build a car at that level. It's so different nowadays. I mean, I think I don't want to say the days are gone of, you know, your backyard guy creating a car that sets the world on fire. I definitely think those guys are out there. I just think he has a lot of access to a whole lot of technology that he didn't have in the past. And if he's sharp enough to come to grips with it and find a way to use it in a unique way, it's going to be 10 times as successful.
Yeah, and I think the challenge is, a fun exercise I do in my mind is to say, okay, well, what if Virgil Exner had access to these machines back in 55? What would he have done? What would Chrysler have done? Or what would, you know, a Harley Earl, what would a Cadillac look like if it was designed then, built today, you know?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, but then the sad part would be, you know, you just give me a really good idea for a movie, though.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to go back in time and ruin that whole evolution shirt we were just talking about. I'm going to see a, you know, CNC milled parts on a Riddler winner in, you know, 72.
Yeah, but, right, exactly.
I think we're at that point where you can make anything you can dream up, but I think, too, at this point, taking into consideration, you know, what you said, okay, if Virgil Exner had access to these things back then, I still think he would have found a way to find restraint with it. And that was one of the other topics that really weighs on me, is you've got to find a way to restrain yourself when you have access to almost unlimited technology.
Yeah, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Precisely. I mean, man, there's a time and a place for it, because it's really easy to trip over that line and say, hey, we've got the scanner, we've got the modeling software to do it, and we've got the machines to mill it. We can do anything we want. I mean, it wouldn't stop you to make a car out of, you know, to say, hey, we've got this chunk of billet that's big enough, let's mill a car out of it.
Yeah.
It would serve no purpose. I mean, it might be neat, but it's a matter of, you know, knowing restraint. And I never want to stop anyone and say, hey, don't use, you know, this technology to better this, because otherwise we wouldn't be at the point we're at anyways. It's always a matter of adopting something, some machine, some tool, some idea, and, you know, putting it together with what you're building at the time to take that art to the next level.
Well, I think the other aspect that needs to be reinforced is a car doesn't need to have that stuff to be cool.
Oh, no.
And I think people can take that away from the shows, the big events, like the big, you know, indoor shows we're talking about, and television and magazines and everything else, to where they might start to think, well, I really need to have some custom machine parts on my car, or people won't think it's cool. I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, you could take any car, make it sit right and make it run right, and have nothing but junk on it and have a super bad car. You know, there's more to it than just that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I always use the example of, you know, do you really need a one-off, you know, the five-axis mill billet aluminum trunk lock on your car?
Right.
What purpose does it serve?
Yeah.
And, you know, you get a lot of people who say, well, I just want it because this car had it. And you think, okay, well, what does it do for your car? You know, you've got to have kind of that acid test where you say, do all of these things that you want, you know, equate to any kind of success for the project?
Yeah.
And that's a really easy thing to trip over and decide, hey, I need that simply because I read in a magazine feature that this car had it. And if that car is in the magazine, well, it's better than mine. And for me to be at that level, I have to have this plus this.
Yeah, which kind of gets to something that you originally said that I also don't really like, and that is the Me Too people who don't really have an original thought in their head, but they thought, you know, well, he's got that and he won, and he's got that and he won, so I want to win, so it needs that. You know, it needs to have all these things, and that's the stuff that I don't like to see. And not everybody's got it in them to be a car designer, a builder, a mechanic, a racer, or whatever, and that's cool, and there's room for everybody. You know, you don't have to be a, you know, a wannabe. And it brings up a story, getting back to the America's Most Beautiful Roadster competition. I knew a guy who was a racer in the NMCA for a while, is when I knew him. His name's Bob Rieger, and he had a lot of financial resources behind him. And when he came into the point of his life where he had enough money to play with the big boys, he got into the custom car indoor show scene and built and had some cars built for him, and he wasn't winning, and he was mad because he's like, I've got all the same stuff, I've got the same amount of money in it, you know, what's the deal? And there was the politics of the show and blah blah blah, so he left the show scene where it was purely subjective and got into racing, which is something that if you don't win the race, you don't win the race, you know.
Right.
And somebody gave him a hard time because, again, he had a lot of financial resources. And they said, well, you know, just like your car show thing and now racing, I mean, you do this, your wallet is the thing that wins the races. You know, you got enough money to do it, so that's why you're a winner. And he took his wallet out of his back pocket and he threw it on the front seat of his race car and said, how fast is it going to go? You know,
that's
and I thought that was pretty cool.
And that's that weird kind of thing we run into, though, is where a lot of people, there's a backlash against it. It's, oh, this guy just, he can afford to build a car that big. That's why he has the coolest thing. And, well, you could say that about anything. I mean, if you've got unlimited funds, yeah, you're going to have the coolest, you know, faucet on your sink in the world, or, you know, you're going to have the coolest watch.
But I don't think it goes hand in hand, because I know
no.
There are people with a lot of money with really ugly cars.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And That's why I think you'll see a lot of guys out there who build a number of cars over the years who might have money, and you can kind of split them out and say, hey, well, this guy built a lot of cars and every one of them is cool. Well, at that point, look at the people he had involved with those cars. And it's a guy who's made really wise decisions, not only in the vehicle he chose to build, but who he had involved with it for design, construction, everything like that. It's a matter, you know, again, money can't buy taste. And, you know, I think if you've got that combination of money and taste, well, fantastic. You're one of the guys, you know, that I love seeing at the top of that whole game, where when your car's in the grade eight or takes the big trophy home, that's cool because I can kind of get behind it and say, you know, awesome.
Yeah, right.
But again, you know, if I see a sea of, you know, Me Too cars where every car has the same thing that, you know, Joe Blow's car had 7 months ago in the magazine, it really kind of sours your taste for it.
Yeah.
You know, it always reminded me, you remember those, God, remember car show videos from like the 80s? You'd put them in, it was like, you know, it was like the Sacramento Autorama. And it would be this really cheesy kind of like B.B. King style guitar riff playing in the background, and the camera would sweep all around the show and give you these weird angles of cars.
Yeah.
I always thought, you know, I wanted to put one of those together, and people are going to hate me for this, but I wanted to do my own of like a recent show where you have like Alice Cooper's clones playing and just go past a sea of all the same, you know, it's like pro touring car after pro touring car after pro touring car.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I mean, build what you like, but it's really tough, you know. It's hard. I mean, I guess the guy that I don't like in that world is the guy who built an exact clone of eight other cars out there and then complains that nobody appreciates his car.
Yeah, and doesn't use it for what it's capable of, you know, in the pro touring exactly. world. We see people there that there are people that have a pro touring car that they're beating the tar out of every single weekend, and then there's some that never, you know, leave a trailer. And it's like, well, why did you do that if you're not going to drive it, you know?
That's tough to look at, you know, the guy who has, you know, oh, I've got 1,200 horsepower and it's a super exotic engine and it runs for 4 minutes at a time.
Well, and not only that, but I mean, the stuff that isn't the super exotic, because now, you know, you say pro touring and basically that whole thing was cars that look cool and perform well. There is definitely a formula now of parts that you can buy and have shipped in, and they're GM crate engines or a Ford crate motor, and this isn't something exotic. I mean, this is something that's expensive, but it's not necessarily exotic, and these cars could be replaced and they could be fixed and they could be raced and whatever. And the people that, I guess, they just put a bunch of money in them and take them to a show and say, hey, look at me, and it's not being used for what those parts were made for, you know, is a little unusual, but that's part of the deal too, you know. I guess if you spend the money on the car, you know, you value not wanting to put it into a wall.
That's another point too. You can, if you think about it, if you go to a shop today and you say, I want to build, let's just say, because everybody knows what it looks like, you say a 69 Camaro, and I want to do a pro touring car, and you say, my budget is $150,000. They're going to throw you almost a package. It's going to be this chassis, these brakes, these wheels, you know, this drive line, and it's all stuff you can buy off the shelf. And to me, that's mind-boggling. I mean, you think about that. You can basically go to a catalog today and build a really well-performing car just by ordering parts and
yes.
bolting them together.
Yeah,
and know it's going to work.
The parts availability, because of those same machines and manufacturing processes that we talked about before, technology, you can off the shelf buy parts out of a box that'll perform better than like anything that was in Trans Am in the 60s that was hand built by real race people.
Oh, exactly. And this is where we have that kind of weird segmentation at this point, where you can do that kind of stuff, and that's one whole side, and that's a beautiful thing, because that spawned an entire industry, and it gives a lot of people jobs doing things they love. on the same token, there's that other side of it where it's kind of the one-off crowd. And this is when we get back into that, the indoor show cars, the million-plus dollar show contenders, where that's a whole different world. That's, you know, if you take a car and bolt it together out of a catalog, no matter how nice you detail it, you're not going to compete at that upper level.
Right.
It's just a different set of criteria. And I think, you know, that's something that kind of falls back and trying to educate the general public on, so that they understand that you know, it's two totally different ball games. Here's why it's a different ball game. I mean, neither one's right, neither one's wrong. It's, you can't argue the fact that, you know, say again, just because we've been mentioning it through the whole thing, Foose's Imposter. That car is on a totally different plane than the guy who put together a Mustang that he's going to run every weekend at a good guy's autocross.
Right.
It's totally different purposes, obviously totally different cars, you know, really different mindset. But, you know, again, kind of the interest of, you know, can't we all just get along? It's neat that everybody who's really a car person can appreciate both sides of that.
Yes. And I remember talking with Troy Trepanier a few years ago, well, probably 10 years ago now. And early on, he said kind of that same point. He's like, I have built cars where we bought new parts and cleaned them and detailed them and made them as nice as those parts could be, and made a super, super nice car out of parts that you could get. And now I wanted to go somewhere else. And so it's a different build, a different level of designing and making and building the parts instead of opening the box and painting them.
Right on. That's, man. Yeah, we live in the greatest time. But
yeah, and it's totally cool to think, you know, and again, I'm not griping about any of this stuff, and I appreciate all of it in every single direction. I just think it's cool to, I think we need to every once in a while stop down and say, no, you have to appreciate what's available right now and what's going into these cars, and not just walk past them and go, yeah, those wheels suck, and move on. Or, I don't like that color, or, gee, that was dumb. You know, it's like, that's a tremendous injustice to everything. You know?
Exactly. Man, to me, that's like doing that to somebody's kid, you know? Oh, man, nice ears, you know?
Well, if you could go order from Summit Racing a new pair of ears for the kid, it'd be a different story, you know?
Oh, man, if I could do that for me. Have you seen me?
That'd be a different set of parts altogether.
Multiple mortgages on the house, and I'd be...
Yeah, you can do it. I guess you can,
be,
you know?
Yeah. I'd be modeling underwear someplace. Yeah, that'd be a whole different ballgame today.
There's your other, that reality show came and went, I think, the Beverly Hills plastic surgery. And you mentioned those videos from the 80s. I've made those with the bad car show stuff and the music and everything else. So I know where you're at. It would be fun to do.
I thought that'd be great.
How bad would it be to see, you know, a 5-axis CNC toilet car compete next year?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But you got to have a corporate-sponsored one, no less. If you, like, the people from Kohler step in and, like, apply that, you know, that touch thing they have where you can just touch the faucet and it turns on and off.
Yeah, right.
See, I just gave an idea right out there. Next car that shows up with that.
There's another one.
Heard it first here.
Yep. You can get Charmin to co-sponsor.
Oh, my God.
And it would have to have – you could have a Whipple supercharger on in honor of Mr. Whipple.
Oh, my gosh. You see the car out there. It's overheating on the side of the road. There's all kinds of blue fluid leaking out.
Yes, it's bubbling out the tank. You should be in car design or something, man. You're really good at this.
I'm thinking about it.
Oh, that'd be too cool.
Seeing the forums, it doesn't look too hard.
The world's most precise toilet tank.
This would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Brush stainless, you know, handle, flush handle.
Summit will have to carry those. I can't even think of the technical term for it now. A little floater that sits in the tank.
The flapper valve, you mean?
The little floater ball that sits at the top.
Oh, yeah. The float.
The float. There we go. Technical word, the float. Thanks.
Yes. There'd be the plastic ones in different colors, and then there'd be, you know, a billet one and a polished.
See? Satin finished.
Uh-huh. Right.
Pinstripers will get a hold of them. They'll have, you know, float jams. That'll be cool.
Float jams. It'll be oversized flush ports, you know, so this thing dumps all 1.6 liters in half the time.
Ooh. Like a flaked float. That'd be awesome. I could see that.
Yeah.
Now we're getting someplace. Maybe that's the next step. It's not even toilet seats for the pinstripers. Just whole, like, the tank.
It's going to be a whole billet toilet.
Oh, my gosh.
That'll have some ceramic, you know, baked on coating.
Or you have the guys who go out and specifically source, like, you know, traditional toilets, you know, anything pre-53.
Right. The no billet crapper box.
I didn't even clean the inside. Like, oh, great.
Yeah. It's a ceiling mount tank, you know, with a big pipe coming down and a chain.
Yeah, but the rat rod guys would lower it so it sits below the bowl.
I got a rusty toilet in our shop right now, I think, as a matter of fact, for those guys. Not by choice.
That's worth something to somebody.
Yeah, but that's just it, you know. Take what's available and apply it to whatever.
And, you know what? Again, I think that brings it back, though. You know, think about it. We're at a world where you could build anything today, and you can make it cool. And to me, that, like I said, I'm sitting here right now, and it makes your head want to explode because you could do almost anything. And you're only limited, really, by creativity, budget, you know, and then the willingness to put up with, you know, 1,400 people on Facebook telling you that, you know, your choice of center caps was stupid.
Yeah, right. So take me through it was called the Dart SL, right? Is that the
yes.
car that you guys designed? You guys, there's not more than one of you. You designed
there, and there was a lot of hands in that car.
The Big Oak guys built?
Yeah, I tell you, Will and the team over at Big Oak absolutely killed that car. He came to me with that car. They had already chopped the top on it and started to move a few things around. And they were kind of at a crossroads because, you know, as you know, a 65 Dart isn't really, no disrespect to the guys who originally designed the car. It isn't really a pretty car.
Well, and there's so many things about that. Again, getting back to something that Troy said, build something different so that it blows people away. And that was definitely different. And you're right, that car in its original form, it's funny when you said the top was chopped. Initially, I had no idea because it just looked so right.
Oh, and they did a fantastic job of it. I mean, the way that when he first called me and showed me some pictures of what he had done, I absolutely flipped because, A, you know, I'm a big Mopar guy. B, if you have that kind of form already figured out and you come to me with it, I'm excited because I know we're going to talk on, you know, a level where we kind of understand each other. We can see the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it a whole lot easier, I think, on my side. I don't want to say that. No, I shouldn't say that out loud. What made it really difficult for me, they presented me with something that really needed a front end design, really needed something to go on the tail end to kind of bring that up to speed. And I was fortunate to have, a client and Will who just kind of trusted me and sort of let me loose to do my own thing. And it was really cool because I kept looking at the car and thinking, well, it's a Dart. You know, if you had a Dart back then, it goes back to kind of what we talked about earlier, you would have wanted to find a way to up-level that car a little bit.
Yep.
And the potential there was, okay, if we take this car, it's going to obviously go a little more modern because, you know, at the time they were talking, you know, supercharged Hemi, Pro Touring kind of look for the car, all custom chassis. I knew we weren't going to be limited to a situation where I was going to say, great, now I've got to find a way to put bubble skirts and wide white walls on this car.
Right. There was definitely a direction.
And, it was great because it made sense to me to bring in, you know, you had the modern Hemi. Well, I figured, okay, we'll pay some, you know, we'll pay a little respect to the modern Dodge look. And we'll put a crosshair grill into it. And we started to really play with that. And that kind of refined itself pretty well. And once we got around to doing the tail end, I just kept thinking, man, you know, what if the, you know, because at that point in time, the Imperial cars were already kind of starting to feel that they were going to be shoved on the way out. You could tell by, like, you know, mid-60s, it was still a good idea, and it was definitely something to have and aspire to own an Imperial, but it wasn't quite, you know, they didn't have the market anymore. So I thought, well, if they had made a Dart in the Imperial line, what would the back end look like?
Ah, that all makes sense to me.
Okay, so I'm glad you catch it.
Well, I mean, it looked great. Just looking at it as its own, it was a very great-looking car. But now that I know where that kind of theme came from, it makes total sense.
And it was funny. We wanted to do something different, and Will says, and originally you'd come up with a couple modular designs, and Will said, well, what if we just did one big panel? And I thought, man, well, that's going to be big. And started to design that. And fortunately, again, going back and kind of tying in with the modern machinery and things we have at our disposal, we sent the designs off to Greenings. And in typical Greenings fashion, they knocked it so far out of the park, you know, we had to go and drive three counties over to find it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just looked, they did an incredible job taking a vision in my head, which was basically, you know, some sketches and drawings with little arrows and notes all over the place, and to this unbelievably finished piece that looks like it could have been a factory part.
Well, that's the thing. If you didn't release your drawings of the front end design and the various different ones versus stock and the choices, somebody could make an argument that that was a factory piece. It looks like it was made in the time period. It looks like it fits the car. And again, you nailed it. Getting back to what we're talking about before, this just wasn't some piece of aluminum that was spit out on a machine. I mean, this belonged in there, and it paid homage to the original design and shape and feel, but tuned it up and kind of fixed it all.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that, and man, you know, that makes me, that you made my whole year so far.
Well, you've been having a crappy year if I helped. No, but really, it looks great. It's organic. It fits. It's cool. That's the way these parts should be made.
And it was neat too, because you know, when we had started to discuss, you know, making it one piece to look like, you know, an older part, we were trying to balance out how we were going to put some modern lighting into it. And fortunately, everything worked to a point where it does, it almost looks like a factory piece that's been retrofit with LED taillights. And,
right,
you know, it's one of those things where, you know, knock on wood, it all came together really well.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the color they chose for the car, I'll be honest, when he first presented it to me, I cringed and I went, oh no, I don't know if that's going to work. And I kept thinking about it, and I said, you know, it's going to come around. And, you know, finally one day, you know, I woke up and went, you know, it really makes sense, because I started to think, okay, if the car is going to debut in Detroit, and there's another whole topic. You and I, we should have a talk just strictly about picking color for Detroit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
With the lighting in Cobo Hall, especially upstairs like that, certain colors really work. Other colors kind of either just like fade into the background or just flat out don't work on a car. And fortunately, with the surroundings in that building and everything that's going on with the lighting and the tones that it lets off, that green made that car just absolutely pop.
Oh, it looked alive.
It was awesome. And it was funny because I had a lot of people say, man, I'm looking at pictures of other cars from upstairs that you can always see that green just glowing off in the background.
Yeah. And the green is a very vivid green. It's got a lot of metallic in it. It's got a lot of pearl in it. And it is a show car color. You know, it as you mentioned before, that if a kid walked into that show and saw that, that's going to leave a mark. You know, that's the kind of color that is.
Definitely. And that's why that car has, you know, not just because I had the opportunity to work on it, but that car has a really special place in my heart, because that's the kind of car that would have done it for me as a kid. I would have gravitated right towards that because it was bright, and then I would have started picking things apart on it that I really liked.
Yeah, yeah. And the Big Oak guys just did a tremendous job in putting it together, because holy cats, is that a nice car.
it's unbelievable. They're the most down-to-earth people. I love them. Will's a fun guy to talk to. Definitely one of my favorite builders. And I really hope, I know he's got a great name for himself out there, but I hope this opens it up to him having an even bigger audience now.
Yeah, we had the privilege of spending the weekend with those guys at the CarCraft Summer Nationals last year. We were in the Pro Builder Shootout, and they had their 57 with them. The slugger car, I think that's what it was called. Built for the ball player, and the seats were sewn up, and they looked like a catcher's mitt almost, the way the stitching was, and the leather and the material, and that car was just super, super nice. And I'm like, you know, we definitely don't belong in the same circle, because that car was over the top, and those guys were so cool. We spent a lot of time with him. It was really neat.
He's a great guy. He's a very talented builder. Like I said, I mean, they build such a clean car, and this was just a little bit outside of what they normally do. You know, it's quite a radical car when you get down to it.
Well, plus being more of a muscle car, you know, it seems like their history is a little skewed a little bit earlier on most of the stuff they do. But they nailed it. They can play in any circle. Absolutely.
And I tell you, it was fun too. I mean, because, you know, once we got done with the outside, we played with gauge designs, and we got, once we figured out the instruments, that's another neat thing you can do today. You don't just rely on saying, well, I'm going to put, you know, these gauges into my car that I got off the shelf. We could literally say, well, what do we want the gauges to look like? Have those made, and Classic Instruments killed it on that.
Yeah, that's really cool to have that ability to, first of all, the freedom of a customer that's willing to support all that, and then to actually have companies that can make that stuff.
Definitely. And I don't know if you had a chance to see, I don't want to make this into a name-dropping thing, but
no.
Wayne and Pam at M&M Hot Rod Interiors, they're a great couple, and they're consistently placing with their interior work into like the grade eight. If you look back over the past few years, there's always something from them in there. And they absolutely kill it on that car.
That's cool. And like you mentioned before, the Greening Auto Company's ability to make those parts, how many pieces did those guys make for that car, do you know?
Oh my gosh, offhand, well, I know there's roughly, I want to say 40, low 40s, probably 40 or 41 hand milled parts on that car.
Wow.
And you stop to thinking, you know, there's roughly about 110, 112 just modifications overall to the car.
Yeah, easily, I would guess.
And it was one of those where it would have been funny too to, you know, we should have parked a stock dart next to it, Foo style.
Well, yeah.
And where everything was cut. It was, and the car got cut every which way to Sunday, and if you didn't know it, you'd think, okay, cool, it's a dart that sits right.
Yeah, totally. You wouldn't know if you didn't know.
And that's the kind of stuff that does it for me, you know, and you look back and even the subtle stuff that he did to it with on the front fenders, and I'm a big fan of Coke bottling a car, and, you know, it was out of necessity, those front fenders are bowed, and, you know, that's all done so you can have some kind of a turn radius with the car. And Will was sharp enough, as he and the crew did it, to keep them just in line with the factory bow on the rear quarters.
Yeah.
So everything has a nice flow, and it's just a really, so it's a great, well thought out car, and it's the kind of thing that I think I enjoy being involved with, where there's a million different ideas floating around, but we always seem to gravitate towards just one set of those ideas.
Yeah.
And everything kind of gels.
Yeah, again, fixing the weirdness from the factory. You know, I always think that as a car designer that worked for the OEs, you know, the original drawings are always very fluid and dynamic and very cool. And then, you know, engineering gets a hold of it and they got to ruin it. And safety gets a hold of it and they got to ruin it. And marketing has to add a bunch of garbage to it. And what ends up getting produced, you know, manufacturing needs to change everything because you just can't make that, you know, cheaply. And what we end up driving is nowhere near what the original design was. And I think you've got a real great ability of kind of reaching back and kind of pulling out that original feel of what the car was maybe supposed to be. Who knows? I don't know if what the concept drawings of a 65 Dart even look like, but you would think that it would have been more towards what you guys did than what came out.
You'd hope.
You'd hope, yeah, right. Yeah. Well, they're weird, and that's what's, you know, part of the attraction of those 60s Chryslers and Dodge products, you know, from 55 up through 65 before everything became, you know, kind of real boxy. Those designs, I love them more and more and appreciate the idiosyncrasies and the way that they tried to go in a slightly different direction and push things a little bit. I think that's neat. Some people think, you know, it's ugly. and everybody, you know, whatever you like, but I just think those cars are cool. But then to be able to take one and improve upon it is even better.
And that's the fun of it. You know, I mean, I might every now and then I post something where I complain a little bit, and it's my way of blowing off steam and trying to get a rise out of people. But and it's a fun thing to work in where you get to take cars that, you know, you have a chance to go back and kind of improve upon and put your own unique spin on it. And it's great to have people out there who trust you enough to say, well, look, this is my car. Do your thing. And this is a great case of it, too, where, you know, someone said, hey, I've got this Dart. Please make it cool. And again, you know, Will and the crew went way over and above and beyond.
Yeah. And there's
something really cool.
There's some cars that you can't really do that to and have it be accepted. And again, to use the iconic 69 Camaro, I'm going to say 99 out of 100 attempts to customize a 69 Camaro don't work, only because we have seen so many Camaros and we're so mentally trained to appreciate kind of what they are that if you deviate, your mind just says no, it just rejects it, you know. And I have a problem with that too. And the analogy I'm going to use is classic rock. We have heard Stairway to Heaven 50 billion times, and we don't even listen to that song anymore. But if you take the time to listen, you know, to some of these songs and appreciate what went into making that song that we take for granted now, you know.
Definitely. I agree. And although, you know, and it's funny, I have a joke that I've heard Stairway to Heaven so many times, and I had a friend who listened to it nonstop. And I've always pictured that hell for me somehow would have that playing on a constant loop in the background. And every now and then I'll be driving and you have a station that'll play one like back to back. They'll do one of those weird things. It's like, oh, it's a double play. And it turns out to be the same song.
Right.
Yeah. And I have to stop and I think, did I die?
Yes. Well, you know, what was interesting for me one day, I found that there was a documentary made of the recording of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. And you can find this on YouTube. There is film footage of the recording sessions. And Dark Side of the Moon is such an album to me that was very technical, a lot of synthesizer and stuff. It was hard to envision people playing instruments making that music. You know,
definitely.
And when you see the guys tweaking the knobs on the big Moog synthesizers and the Korgs and all this stuff, this analog junk with patch cords and everything, and they're making what ended up on the album, and you go, wow, people did make that. You know, it just seems screwy that this isn't just something that came out of the radio. There was a recording session, because it doesn't have a very, you know, analog acoustic feel in any way. I had a totally new appreciation of that whole record when I heard that, and an appreciation of Alan Parsons as a producer and all that stuff. And it really just kind of opened my mind to that album again. And I think the same thing happens with cars. You see so many 69 Camaros, and you know, when people try to change them, you know, and they miss. But then you look at it again and go, well, I kind of see where they were going with that, and maybe this could be done. And when a modification really sticks, you go, wow, that's cool.
Right on. And I love the musical analogy. I think that's awesome. You don't stop to think about what goes into making a song and how many different versions of that song there might have been. And, you know, you take like a guitar riff completely for granted. You think, oh, he just, you know, stepped up there and knocked off that riff. That might have been a process of just constant refinement. And again, same thing with the car. You get one idea, and I try to do this with the sketches as we develop them. We'll start with an idea, and well, every now and then they go way off the rails and end up with goofy stuff and notes written all over them. And sometimes a client gets one that has, you know, notes for me on what to pick up to cook dinner. But, you know, you develop things, and something that seems like it fits the car and is really natural was such a struggle to get to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well, and it's almost the same thing. Imagine, okay, you take a 57 Chevy and you make a zillion parts for it, bring it out to a big show, like, you know, whatever, and have people look at it. That's really not much different from taking, you know, AC/DC's Back in Black, right, and playing it live with French horns and expecting people to get it, you know, to figure out what you did or accept it in some way.
And that's it. It's really hard. And that's why I like it when people can see kind of what goes on behind the scenes. Because like you said, you know, you came to an appreciation for the Dark Side of the Moon album. And by the way, I wrote myself a note. I'm going to go look for that now. But
yeah, I forgot what that series is called, but it's on YouTube.
That's awesome. It's little stuff like that. I wish we could do that more on the side of, the design side and even a lot of the fabrication side. I would love to do a whole series where we follow something from Sketchpad clear on through the SolidWorks modeling, you know, maybe bring light to that whole side where we get to see how technology becomes involved, but yet it all starts, you know, from one weird idea.
Well, yeah, definitely. What I think would be fun, and I thought about doing this in the past, is doing a video series or a TV episode or whatnot that only showcased the stuff that didn't make it, and then show the car at the end with what did make it.
That would be...
So people are wondering, it's like, well, I don't know about that fender treatment there, and show the guys working on it, because they did. They worked on it. You know, this was drawn, this was built, this was English wheeled and welded and ground and put together, maybe even went to color before it got scrapped, you know. And then at the end, when the final is revealed, where all these things came together, you go, wow, what a relief that they figured it out.
Because it's a journey. I mean, it's, man... And sometimes you come out of it and you think, I'm never doing that again. And, you know, then the phone rings and, well, you do it again.
Yes.
But, there's so much that goes on behind it. And the struggle that goes into it to try to find a way to bring that idea once you have it locked down and to see it all the way through fruition. I mean, there are times when, you know, maybe something has to be changed on it. You know, I've got that going on with a car now where we've had to kind of, we wanted to have a really super deep grill reveal in the car. And the packaging just isn't going to allow it with where we have to mount things now for the intercoolers and things like that. So as much as I like where it's at, and we found a lot of ways to kind of compensate for it, move things, still in the back of your mind, you're going, man, if only it would have been like that first design.
Right.
You know,
right.
They become kind of like your kids. You become really attached to them. And I think I've learned over the years, too, to not become attached that close to every piece of a car and understand that no matter what, there's going to be some kind of an organic flow to it.
Yeah.
Something's got to give somewhere. So, you know, it's not quite as bad as it is on the OEM side where we say, hey, we're going to do this really cool car. And then the engineers come in and say, well, no, we're not. Because we can't put a chassis under that.
Right. Or we can't put the chassis from the Malibu under that.
Right. That's the whole other part. It's like, hey, it's a really cool design. Can you take 6 inches out of the wheelbase?
Yeah. It's got to fit a Chevy Sonic platform.
Outstanding.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's what we'll do. We'll do a 58. No, well, never mind.
Yeah. No, I know.
The Sunliner on a Focus chassis.
Yes. I don't even know what you're calling that.
I'm going to steer clear of it because it's the first one that popped into my head was very vulgar. So,
yeah, right. Well, there is a word that because you like words, you like new words. I came up with one that I thought you might like, and I call it desirony.
Ooh.
And it's the irony in design where some things just have to be what they have to be, unfortunately. You know.
That, man, nice.
Yeah, I've been sitting on that for a while. So
well played.
That didn't just come out. That was Tuesday morning shower, I think, is where that...
Now I want to see the list of ones that didn't make it.
yeah, we'll make a movie. Well, it does make me think about another way to fuel the fire of the some of the ridiculousness of the indoor car shows to where maybe there needs to be a video or a projection screen and then the cover comes off, you know, so you get the story with it.
That would be neat. I mean, you know, you get kind of that reveal thing going on at the SEMA show.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, like a full-scale production like that would be awesome. Or
and it's
what if you Walt Disney it and you do it every hour on the hour?
Yeah, right, right. It's imposter after all.
By the end of the show,
everyone wants to kill each other.
Nothing but that problem.
We could do the autorama on little boats. You just tour through it.
Now, wait a second. You're onto something here. Yeah. We do this. Okay, the little mobility scooters.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is going someplace. Now,
we'll get Walmart to sponsor it.
Oh, this would be genius.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's build upon this. We've got the SEMA idea figured out. Let's do the indoor car show. We literally bring in cavalcade of customs. It's, you have this series of robot, you know, computer controlled, GPS guided, you know, little mobility scooters.
Yes.
We'll bring in somebody who can just write the worst possible theme music of all time.
Yes. What is the, in the Haunted Mansion, I think they're called the Doom Buggies. So we just chain them all together, you know, so you don't have the freedom to leave.
Oh, yeah. We don't want you stepping out at any point. This is, you're in this for the long haul.
Yeah. You take some points from IKEA where you start at the beginning and there's only one way through. It's the, you know, Hotel California meets IKEA meets It's a Small World. And
the Motorama maze. This would be awesome.
Yes.
And the only bad part would be, you know, if you're constantly covering and uncovering the car, by like the end of the show, it would just have a ton of like little spider web kind of scratches all up the side.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll just illuminate them. You know, they'll just be dark and we'll just flash lights on them so people will be having seizures along the way.
Nice.
Yeah.
They'll give us some good press. I mean, you know, we've got to sacrifice a couple people having seizures for, you know.
Or the theme of this whole episode's kind of been technology. Maybe we can just do some active polarized, like 3D glasses that go to frost before you get to the next car. And then they flick and they allow you to see through them.
You know? You could just put people on people movers.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
This would eliminate, you know what that would eliminate? The whole problem of people stepping in front of you at the show.
Yeah. And the other nice thing is because they only have a certain small amount of time with each car, you charge them again for a second ride so they can get more of it.
And think about how great the pictures would be online. I mean, everything would be from the same angle, but the cool part would be you wouldn't have these pictures where it's like, hey, here's half the car and some dude's head coming in from the side.
Well, actually, we'll just have it so that the pictures are already taken and then they post on your behalf on your Facebook page as you exit.
It just downloads them right to your phone.
Right. When you get in there, it says, you know, and did you say Motorama meaning like boats, like Moat-O-Rama?
That's where I was trying to go. I figured because I was going to adapt that further.
Moat-O-Rama wants to be post on Facebook on your behalf. You have to, you know, allow the app to work.
And the great part is if you fall off one of those boats, you get eaten by something or catch some vile disease. It'll be great.
And yes.
We will talk later on. I have an idea, and I've tried to present this to the Homeowners Association where I live. I've wanted to put in a moat from day one.
Yep. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's... Let's not even go there.
Well, your alligator's getting, you know, a little upset being cooped up in the house, I guess. So
I've offered them, you know, to replace those animals with audio animatronics and just sewage. Mm-hmm. And they said no.
And we could do a little Vegas touch at the end, you know, where two of the displays fight and one sinks.
Oh, my gosh. See, now we're getting something. Maybe we add an extreme thing to it. It's like a reality show where it's like, hey, these cars made it into the Grade 8. Only one survives.
Yeah, there's a Grade 8 demo derby at the end. Oh, man. And now you'll find the people that really have the money. You want to say you got money, you destroy your billion-dollar car at the end of the show.
10 years from now, we'll be sitting here talking about how horrible it's become because it's all corporate now.
Yes. And it's like, you know, the Who, you know, they smash the guitars, you know, same kind of thing.
Exactly. But hey, but see, now this goes back to the Charmin car we talked about earlier. See, it was only what, like maybe like 30 minutes ahead of its time, but it's still.
Right. It's yes. Well, once again, we've thoroughly gone off the rails, so.
Of course. I apologize.
And that's okay. That's what the whole point of this was to really not have a point, so we've achieved
thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah. See, that's why I enjoy it so much.
At least you and I do. Apologies to anybody who burned an hour and a half on this.
Again. But see, the best part comes at the end. See, yeah, so
there's a reason to listen.
That's exactly.
All right, man. Well, listen, I appreciate the insights, and this was fun, and I guess we'll have to book some time to do it again. There's no shortage of silly things to talk about.
Perfect. Looking forward to it.
All right, my man, and congrats again on the grade A car, and look forward to always look forward to seeing new work out of your desk, definitely.
Well, thank you so much, and likewise, man. I love going on to, you know, see what you guys are up to, and I don't want to plug too much, but your muscle car of the week, that's one of the things I look forward to.
Oh, well, appreciate that. Yeah, definitely. And then on our end, we do have a new television deal with the new Revan TV network that launched in December. They're picking up our VA TV show, so that's pretty cool. So
outstanding. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And, of course, all that stuff's online, too. So there you go. I managed to plug for plug.
Beautiful.
All right, man. Until next time. Thanks for listening to this episode of V8 Radio. You know, you can subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, or you can go to our website at v8radio.com and click the subscribe link there, and you'll never miss an episode of V8 Radio. I'm Kevin Oostie, and we'll talk to you next time on V8 Radio.